With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And this week, I'm going to be talking about the German Revolution of 1918. Now, I must admit, I have an agenda this week because my new ebook called Revolution, Reaction and the Birth of Nazism is due out in a week or two, and it's available on Kindle and all other regular e-readers. So keep your eyes peeled for that one. It's a new title that's going to be really, really useful if you're studying this. If you're an armchair historian or enthusiast, or you just generally want to know a little bit more about those formative years after World War I, where Germany was in a ferment of ideologies left and right, when communism and various kinds of nationalistic fascism were competing with one another against liberal democracy to decide the fate of the nation. Now, if there's one man that casts a long shadow over this period of time, even before the advent of Adolf Hitler on the scene, I would say it's Erich von Ludendorff. And I say that for two main reasons. The first is because of his failed offensive in 1918. Now, by 1918, the outlook for Germany was not good. The spring of 1918, well, indeed the winter of 1917, had admittedly seen Russia fall to revolution, but she hadn't left the war yet. And there was, until March 1918, no indication necessarily that she would do. The Americans were now, since April 1917, had joined the war, and they were coming over to Europe in ever greater numbers. And a Royal Naval blockade was strangling Germany. The German inability to knock the Royal Navy out of action in 1916 at the Battle of Jutland had profound consequences, and the German U-boat campaign in the Atlantic was in fact less effective due to the creation of new escort convoy systems than the Royal Naval blockade of German ports was proving to be in the North Sea and the Baltic. So Germany had a limited amount of time left in which to win the war. The clock was ticking, and Ludendorff was the man, hopefully, to deliver the victory. The Kaiser had become a shadowy figure. He had retreated from politics and become a remote figure. He'd had something of a nervous breakdown in about 1916. He'd never been a particularly sound mind, but the pressures of war had obviously been too much for him. And Germany had been ruled essentially by Ludendorff and Hindenburg, both of whom had shown their military prowess initially at the battles of Tannenberg and the Masurian Lakes in 1914. Ludendorff had planned his spring offensive as early back as November 1917, and he believed that if he could create a division between the British and French armies using shock troops, the strategy would be to, that had been learned on the Eastern Front, was to use stormtroopers to destroy vital strategic positions such as communication centres, command centres and transport networks, and then for armies almost to bypass, for them to bypass the bulk of Allied armies and for the remainder of the German army to take those on. And this had worked very well on the Eastern Front. The problem that Ludendorff encountered was that his goals, his strategic goals, kept changing. There seemed to be no overall strategic vision as to what he wanted to achieve. And so when he used the shock troop strategy, initially the British armies were pushed far back, but they tended to abandon territory that was of no strategic use to the British anyway and hold on to that which was useful. The shock troops, who were the best soldiers cherry-picked from German regiments and put into assault brigades, were by and large annihilated in the full-on assaults into the most heavily defended British and French positions. And that left a bulk of the German army that lacked expertise and lacked morale and lacked training and physical fitness and all the rest of it to take on battle-hardened French and British troops. When the advance began to run out of steam in the summer of 1918, and Ludendorff realised that he didn't have the men in the rear to consolidate the gains that the armies had made, the initiative passed to the Allies, led by Ferdinand Foch, who was made Supreme Commander of Allied Forces and eventually made a Marshal of France, and under him, a slightly more reluctant American general, John Pershing, who disagreed with Foch and felt that the Americans should be slightly more independent, as they were now going to be making up the bulk of fighting forces. The counterattack is so successful that by September 1918, the German generals, German High Command, know that the war is lost, and they advise the Kaiser of this. And by October 1918, Ludendorff is openly asking the Kaiser to sue for peace. During the war in Germany, there had been a social truce. The SPD and the Centre and Conservative parties had had something of a gentleman's agreement that they would disengage from politically dueling with one another, and they would unite in order to support a more patriotic national cause. The SPD, the Democratic Socialists, had something of a core of patriotic conservatism to them by 1914, and they all universally agreed that there was nothing more repellent than Tsarist autocracy anyway, that the Kaiser's authoritarian government was nothing compared to what a Germany conquered by Russia would be like. By 1917, however, the SPD had split over the issue of the war, and the USPD, the Independent Social Democrats, had emerged, who were far more left-wing and radical, and were agitating for an armistice, and who were agitating for general strikes. Many of them were sent to jail, the likes of Rosa Luxemburg, Karl Liebknecht and Clara Zetkin, who were the lead revolutionaries, were sent to jail for quite some considerable period of time and were let out under a general amnesty in 1918. By this time, Germany is in some considerable economic strife. The blockade is strangling Germany. There is almost conditions of famine. Perhaps not quite at this stage, but certainly issues of profound hunger. The winter of 1918 is known as the turnip winter, as that's pretty much all there was to eat. And inflation is running rampant. During the war, the massive overspend that the war takes, because obviously no one is expecting a long war, everyone's expecting a short war, and the government had really budgeted for that, the shortfall has to be made up in both borrowing, because the German population are unwilling to really stomach tax hikes to pay for the war, and it's paid for using the printing of money, which, as we know later on, becomes quite catastrophic. So the social truce that existed in 1914, by 1917, and certainly by 1918, has completely broken down, and Germany, the effect of the war, is starting to polarise Germany. The position of particularly the industrial workers of places like Berlin, which was known as Red Berlin, is really starting to polarise. And the final crisis comes in Wilhelmshaven in the northwest of Germany, when the Kaiser's fleet mutinies. And this came as a terrible body blow to the Kaiser. The fleet was one of the institutions that the Kaiser was most beloved of the Kaiser, that he had championed and built up and created into a fighting unit, hopefully to rival the Royal Navy and to champion German prestige around the world. And here it is, rebelling against his rule. I mean, the reasons for the rebellion are quite obvious in that the German High Seas Fleet, which had never quite recovered from the Battle of Jutland, although on points it kind of won the Battle of Jutland, had to retreat from the High Seas just due to the overwhelming size of the Royal Navy, and it was, in 1918, expected to go out and fight one last suicidal battle against the might of the Royal Navy on the High Seas, one which it would inevitably have lost. And the sailors, unsurprisingly, decided they don't want to do that. There had been revolutionary groups in the Navy, much as there had been prior to the Russian Revolution in the Russian Navy. There had been revolutionary groups for a long, long time who had been planning and organising what to do in the eventuality of order breaking down. And they do, they're quite restrained compared to what happens in Russia. They simply arrest their officers and don't execute any of them. And they confine them to barracks. And the Admiral of the High Seas Fleet simply says, well, you know, I have to accept what the men have done. There's nothing I can do. And really, the revolution is effective in like that. The men then go on to engage with the civilian population in nearby towns like Kiel, and the civilian population then encourage the garrison to mutiny. And the moment that the Kaiser becomes aware that his troops are no longer loyal to him, here is where he panics and is persuaded to flee the country. In the south, suddenly you have a Bavarian Socialist Republic emerge, led by Kurt Eisner in Munich. The mutineers at Wilhelmshaven have used the rail network, used the telegraph network to spread their message across Germany very quickly, and within a few days, nearly every hereditary monarch across Germany, because obviously Germany is a federation of small monarchical states coming under the umbrella of a big federal imperial state, all of these little rulers, from Ludwig III in Bavaria to the Kaiser himself, all flee. So within a week, Germany is free of monarchical rule. The final aristocratic chancellor of Germany, Prince Max of Baden, realises that he commands no authority with the general public and hands over very quickly to Friedrich Ebert, head of the SPD. And the reason he does that is because he knows that Ebert, as a moderate socialist, as a democratic socialist, is the only bulwark that the elites have between themselves and a communist revolution. They've seen what's happened in Russia, and in many ways the elites in Germany learned the lessons of what had happened in Russia and play a very clever game. Obviously, to them, having a democratic socialist isn't a great turnout, but it's an awful lot better than having the German equivalent of the Bolsheviks in Germany. And Friedrich Ebert is as good as his word. He is an avowed anti-revolutionary. He doesn't really want to see the end of the monarchy. He says, you know, it is. He describes the revolution as a poison to him. And when he has to accept the Kaiser's abdication, he says he does it with a heavy heart. And in January 1919, when there is a communist uprising in Berlin, as workers start to see the gains that they have made in November be whittled away, it's Ebert who employs the Freikorps, who are right-wing, nationalistic, demobbed paramilitaries, men who are fresh back from the front, accompanied by younger men who never got to see any battle during the war and who want their own piece of the action, united in a fierce anti-communism. It's these guys that come and slaughter the communists of Berlin at Friedrich Ebert's behest. This leaves Germany in an interesting situation. the moderate Social Democrats, who have inherited power and have to do the unpleasant task of signing the Treaty of Versailles and agreeing to all the painful clauses therein, they have made a Faustian pact with the right. They don't get rid of the top brass of the army, because without the top brass of the army, who are old conservatives from Prussian Junkers, they won't have any sway over the Freikorps or any serving soldiers. So they need to have a relationship with the top brass of the army. And Ebert and Wilhelm Groener, who is the chief of the general staff at the time, come to an understanding that the army will protect the government in return for the government, the new socialist government, not meddling in any of the practices of the army. The civil service goes largely unchanged, so all the infrastructure of the civil service, which is absolutely vast, that has been largely conservative with the small c under the Kaiser, is carried on into the Weimar Republic, and the judiciary don't change either. So all the conservative mechanisms of the Kaiser's empire are carried on into the Weimar Republic, and so any kind of liberal instinct that the Weimar Republic might have has to be practically carried out by deeply conservative enemies of the Republic. But of course, the alternative for Ebert would have been to have some kind of alliance with the communists, the KPD, the Spartacists who rose up in Berlin, both of whom are again committed to destroying a liberal republic and replacing it with something more favourable to the new Soviet Russia. So it's not really much of a choice at all. It's these circumstances of how the revolution unfolds that give us the shaky republic that comes to replace Imperial Germany, and the fundamental instabilities, the fundamental cracks within that shaky republic, are later to be exploited by Adolf Hitler. Now, of course, you can find out all about this in the aforementioned ebook, Revolution, Reaction, and the Birth of Nazism, Germany 1918 to 1923, and that's out in a couple of weeks, downloadable for a small stipend to your Kindle. And if you need to contact me or talk to me or inquire about anything I've said in this podcast, you can get me at www.explaininghistory.com. And you can sign up for our monthly newsletter there as well, which keeps you abreast of all the announcements, some of the new titles that are coming out. So make sure you do that, and I'll catch you on the next podcast. Thank you very much.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.